Welcome back to The Brandon White Show, where we have conversations worth listening to give you an edge to win in your business and your life. I'm your host, Brandon White. Here we go. Nissan, what's happening, man?
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, man. Thanks for joining today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I was excited. I read about Emma Justine Color and Extension Lounge. I think I got that right. And being one of the best places to work in America, voted by Inc. magazine this year, 2022. And I said, we got to have these guys, ladies, on the show because you're a peak performer building a culture that in today's world can be really challenging. And of all places, and I mean this in the most loving way, I just didn't expect it to see that in a salon, which can be a interesting place from what I understand of all the businesses to work because of the business model. And you and your wife have been able to accomplish that. So thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, absolutely. Not only in a salon, but also in Kentucky, which is the other challenging part.
Well, that's an interesting point because you're in Louisville, right?
Yeah, we're in Louisville. The salon is in what we call a historic Middletown district, but it's, yeah, Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah, Middletown. I was looking at that and then I saw Louisville. So Middletown is a area of Louisville.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So Nissan, I want to get to your story on how you even created this salon, but, and go over that sort of journey, but how have you been able to do this? And I was trying to remember, I was fumbling around here before we jumped on because you've done some very atypical things for a salon in the way of giving people time off, I think, and basically your whole approach. So how did you even come up with this?
Yeah, I think a big part of our strategy was exactly that. How do we become different from the industry? And I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head earlier when you said, how do you get a salon to be in the top 500 places to work for? Because salons are typically known for a lot of drama, right? There's a lot that could happen in a salon environment. So initially, we started with a business plan and a model. And then we, over the years, we've tweaked it. And it's really, it's a never-ending process. We learn every day. We become better every day. And we're humbled by the award that we got. It's actually right behind me here. We're humbled by it. But at the same time, we also know there's so much more that we could do better. And so that's kind of exciting because so much more things that we could change and tweak and really provide an even better environment for our team. So there's always more to look forward to. But I guess, Brandon, going back to your question, how do we end up being salon owners? My wife, after she graduated the hair school, she worked at a few salons. She worked for a small salon. She worked for a corporate salon. The salons that she was a part of, it wasn't the great of environment. And I even remember we used to share a car back then. We were newly married. We shared a car. And I remember dropping her off at work and she would literally cry in the car because of how stressed out she would be wanting to go into the salon because of the work environment, especially being new out of school. So her goal from the start was to create an environment, to create a salon that was just a different vibe altogether. And so when she put together a plan of, okay, here's what I wanted to look like. Here's the process I want to have as far as compensation, as far as team building, as far as one-on-ones, we began looking for a property. We had some lease options. We looked at some properties that we could potentially purchase, but her vision was a little bit bigger than what we could afford when we were ready to open the salon. And so it was really a two-year process for us to even find a location that was affordable and a location that would kind of meet to the standard and the vision that she had in mind. So we landed across a property in Middletown. It was a historic property and it needed, required a lot of renovations. We actually got an award for the design of the salon in 2019. Salon Today, which is the biggest publication for those that are in that field, in that industry. Yeah, they listed us as National Distinguished Salon of the Year and we got an award for that. And we flew out to Atlanta to be a part of like the celebration. But to really get the building up and running and get it up to speed, what we ended up having to do is actually sell a house. We sold our house. We also both ride motorcycles. We ended up So on our motorcycles, and really, that's kind of the sacrifice. And we pumped every dollar we had into the renovation of the salon, and here we are today.
So I'm going to go back. You summarized that in 5 minutes and 14 seconds. I want to go back because there's more to it. And you've mentioned several times that your wife had a vision and you together put together a business plan. And you referenced this, accounted at least three times in that summary. What was the business plan and how did you go about building the business plan? Did you read a book? How did you even approach it? One. And then two is, what was in the business plan?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. So my background, I actually come from a corporate environment. I worked for a Fortune 100 company and I managed everything that has to do with contact center operations. So I'm very numbers driven. I'm very analytical. So to me, a decision typically backs into some sort of a number. So a big part of a business plan is really fully understanding the numbers and fully understanding what would it take for us to survive for 6 months, for 9 months, for 12 months. What would it take, you know, as far as the investment of the property that we were looking to purchase? And so part of us selling the house was part of the plan. It's not only that we needed the money for the renovations, we also needed to make sure that we didn't have an extra payment on top of it, that we have to keep up with a commercial property and that mortgage. And now we have to keep up with the mortgage payment for the house. And so in order for us to make sure we were doing it the right way and not really skipping out on some of the details and we're fully invested, this is where decision was made to sell the house. So we moved in with my parents and my wife survived 2 years of living with her in-laws. So that was a fun time. So the business plan really had how many chairs do we need? The business plan had how many total guests we would need to have in the first 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. What is our average ticket price that we're shooting for? So if we are checking out 5-10 guests a day, what should be the average ticket price? We also looked at what percentage of the sales that come from the retail side of things like shampoo, gel, different types of products like at-home maintenance products. What would be the minimal standard that we will have to sell in relation to the service? So it's like a service, retail to service percentage is the official term that we use. So that was a big part of it. And then another big part of it is how do we get the right leadership on board? And can we afford the right manager to help us drive the operational side of things? And so, yeah, that's kind of like the high level summary of a business plan.
Well, I think you're touching on something really important and I want to unpack it because very often aspiring entrepreneurs, even existing entrepreneurs who have gotten some traction and may have hundreds of thousands, if not millions in revenue, still sometimes you can go by the seat of your pants if you have a product or a service that just sort of takes off for whatever reason. And people think about the traditional business plan, Nissan, as the problem solution, et cetera, which it is. And in your case, the problem was salons don't work as well as they could and working environments aren't as drama-free as they could be and all these other things that really drive the drama, which is incentives and how people are compensated and things like that. But you actually jumped right into the spreadsheet. And I always say that is actually where the business plan is. But everybody avoids the spreadsheet. One is because it's hard. It's complicated. Just learning Excel or sheets, which is a glorified still, I'm sure they'll get there, glorified Excel tool, let's say. It's that everybody avoids it. And I think that avoiding that is a huge mistake. And sometimes someone will say to me, he said, oh, I have the financials and I'll look at, they'll have a P&L. And it'll be some detail there. Here's how much I think it's going to cost for the product. And here's our G&A expenses. But they don't expand. They say, well, we're going to get credit card. We're going to get our money every month. Well, you're not going to get your money every month once you get to tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, because the credit card company is going to hold money back because they're going to be afraid of chargeback. So you're actually not going to have cash flow. And by the way, where's your marketing tab? And where's your HR tab? Not we think we're going to pay these people on this G&A line of salaries, but how does that break down? Did you account for FICA and Social Security taxes and the 15% employment tax that you're going to have to pay in addition, fully loaded, I'm saying here, on top of that, and that you're going to need to write that check to the U.S. government every single month, whether or not you have the cash or not, because you as the executive are actually personally responsible for it, corporation or no corporation. I'm saying everything that I know you know, Nissan, but really for listeners in there is that's the business plan. You could almost just do a spreadsheet model and run your business off of it. And I think what I'm hearing that you did was, and it's not, by the way, my brother always says, why don't you get out of the spreadsheet? Like, let's just go sell things. And that's true. And the spreadsheet might not be right, but by building the spreadsheet, you are engineering a target that you know you have to hit versus winging it and not having this model that you can tweak. You might not make your sales that month, but at least you can make the inputs in your spreadsheet to know what the impact is, which is, hey, we're going to have to sell the motorcycles next month, honey. And you know, that's the way it's going to be. So I think that's really important. Has that been a vital tool for you as you've grown the business? How long are you in business now?
Yeah, Brandon. Yeah, we've been in business for 4 years now. October marked our 4-year anniversary. So we've been in business for 4 years, and you're so spot on. The Excel sheet is where it starts. I live inside the spreadsheets. Like, if I can't make a single decision without having Excel up, without creating columns and line items and figuring out how to calculate and back everything into a number. It doesn't, like you said, it doesn't have to be accurate, but it is backbone. It's like the skeleton. Without having a spreadsheet, without being able to fully calculate every detail, you're kind of going into the business, you know, with your eyes closed. And that's the scary part. And there's plenty of successful business owners that have been successful at it. But then, you know, if you look at the actual data, how many businesses close within the first year of opening, within the first 5 years of opening, the data really tells you that there's a lot of times just poor planning. And as a result, that's why the business has shut down. There's so many businesses that close within the first year of opening. I believe they said like 70% of new businesses close within the first year. And the spreadsheet is kind of where it all starts.
So how's that dynamic of you using the spreadsheet? Your wife is the visionary talent and actually in the beginning and probably still does color hair and do extensions and generating the revenue. How is the dynamic between you two when she says, hey, Nissan, we need to upgrade to this new Cosmoglow light and everybody needs it. And you whip up this spreadsheet and you say, well, we can't have five. Or does she, or are you in sync with that? Because that's an important, and it's not your husband and wife, but that's an important dynamic between founders a lot of the time.
Yeah. Oftentimes the way it works for us is she would say, I would like for us to get this. What would it take? And that's kind of the second part is what would it take to get to this point? Everything is, yeah, we can put something on a credit card and buy this and buy that and buy everybody new hair dryers or scissors, you know, whatever the case might be. But the right question is, what would it take? And then as we put together a plan, everything has a plan to it. So if she wants to change all the mirrors out in the salon because she wants to refresh the look of the salon, what would it take to get to the point? How long would it take? And also, if we invest this much money, what's the revenue? What's the return on our investment? Is it really something that it's good to have? We would like to have it, or is it an essential item? And is it an item that will also generate some kind of revenue on the back end? So different ways of kind of looking at whether or not we're going to come through and make that purchase.
I think that's the other thing is that people think you write the business plan and then it's over. The business plan is dynamic and it's changing and it's always trying to hit these goals and solving for X. And I think sometimes people are just, they're so passionate about it, but you don't want to be passionate and broke. You generally want to be passionate and rich. And I think that that's really the mistake where things go wrong. I had a few questions because you covered a lot of stuff. Actually, how did you and your wife meet? Because you're building a salon in Kentucky. And I mean, everything here is, I don't want to say it's counterculture, but you think of Kentucky, you think of horse racing and these big hats and this sort of other thing. And you both, I say this, let me don't, if you were to say like, do these people fit here? It's, you wouldn't just say there. You might say, well, maybe they fit in LA or Miami or one of these. I mean, look at you. You're even dressed modern for those listening versus, I don't want to say the Southern, but it's very different. And it's very interesting how you've been able to sort of do that. So how'd you meet?
Yeah, so it's an interesting story. So originally, my family is from Russia. We got here when I was 10 years old. So I grew up pretty much in Louisville, in Kentucky. My wife is from a small town next to near Paoli, Indiana. She grew up out in the country. They have 24 acres. They have horses. So she grew up being homeschooled. So even her and I are both from two different cultures, and we have two different backgrounds. But the way we met originally is my cousin Rachel, she invited me to go to Six Flags. We used to have Six Flags in our city. And my cousin Rachel invited me to go with her because a lot of her friends were going, but she wanted me to come so that she has someone that she knows there. And there's going to be other group of people that are kind of syncing up and meeting each other. And so she wanted us to kind of ride together and basically be her support, so to say. And my original answer was like, absolutely not. I don't want to be the only guy there. I'd rather you go by yourself and I can drop you off. And so she ended up convincing me because she said, okay, we'll just go for a few hours and then we can come back. So I ended up going with her. And it's just so happened where one of those friend of a friend, we were on a roller coaster together. And so we just ended up sitting, I ended up sitting right next to her. And so that's how we met. And so the rest is history.
How does a Russian family immigrating from Russia wind up in Kentucky?
Another good question. So we came through we got what they call a refugee status because the town that we came from was under the influence of certain regimes. And so families that were fleeing that town, the United States gave them refugee status. And so we were originally supposed to go to Boston, Massachusetts, and somehow something changed in the paperwork because there were sponsored groups that were supporting families. And we ended up being rerouted to Louisville, Kentucky. Like, so it's kind of happened by accident. And so here we are. Yeah.
So you came here when you were 10.
Yeah.
What was it like for you to wind up in America? I mean, 10 years old, you do remember things. I mean, you're enough. Were you in shock? Were you excited? Was America what you had envisioned? I mean, in general, when I travel overseas, the perception of America is very much based on the major metropolitan cities, New York, LA, San Francisco, maybe Miami, and a few other places. What was that like for you showing up in Boston, for one, which is also a major city, but then coming to Kentucky?
I wouldn't say that it was close to what we joke as the paradise, but at that time, it was pretty close to it because the environment that we left, it was just, as an example, literally 6 months before we left, there were several attempts of kidnapping of myself, my brother, and my sister. And there were even times where my dad had to separate us to live with different family members as a result of just things that were happening within the city. And this is, if you think about the 90s and when the wall fell, there was a lot of government where the government has fallen. And now you had gangs that were forming. And these gangs were taking over factories. They were taking over different businesses that used to be owned by the government. And so the whole city was split into different gangs were responsible for different parts of the city. And so it was very violent. And my dad, we started out being a wealthy family, but it kind of escalated really quickly to the point where we went from having a maid in the house to not having anything to within 2 years. So the world completely shifted for us. And even providing dinner for his kids, my dad would go out to the flea market and figure out a way to try and make deals, like trade a pair of clothes for food. And so, yeah, it was horrible. And so throughout that whole process of if you're wealthy, you're on somebody's radar. And if you're in Russia, it's not a good radar to be on. It's not about being paying taxes. It's about who knows about you that you have money and who's after it. So there was, like I said, several attempts of kidnapping. One time I was actually snatched, but I was rescued. So when we landed here, we felt like we were in a paradise because we finally felt at peace. We never had to look behind our backs. We were never worried. So just that one piece of no one is after my life is, we were so excited to finally make it. And my grandmother, you know, when she got out of the airplane, she wanted to kiss the ground as a sign of just being appreciative that we made it out alive. So, yeah.
What year is this?
We came in 97.
And what was the town?
The town is pronounced Nauchik. It's right next to the Caucasus region. A lot of people are familiar with Mount Elbrus. It's one of the highest mountains in that region. And it's called Eurasia, like European side of Russia. It's next to Georgia, like on the other side of the mountain. So it was during that time, there was also a lot of conflicts between Georgia, Chechnya, and Russia.
So would you go, is there any interest in going back? Like, you're a very happy person for a person who has been kidnapped, and you're like, oh yeah, I was kidnapped and then rescued. That's a nonchalant. I mean, that could be, some people would be traumatized forever from that experience. Is one, is you seem really happy, and two is, would you go back to Russia? Like, is that ever on your radar? Or are you pretty much like, yeah, no, this is just a better place?
Yeah. It would be nice to show Amy, my wife Amy, you know, my hometown and kind of where I grew up, but I have zero desire to go back myself. I've kind of left an impression of like almost to the point of like hating the place where I come from because of just having not the greatest of memories. But my wife and I, we've traveled all over Europe. We've been to Italy. We've been to France. Greece. We've traveled all over Europe, and Russia hasn't quite made the list. Maybe one day it'll make the list, but I'd rather not go back.
It sounds like you shouldn't risk it. I mean, there seems like the Russian regime has a very long memory, and you know, they keep track of those sorts of things. So you come to America, you originally land in Boston, some paperwork gets changed, your family gets put in Louisville, Kentucky. You meet your wife, Amy, through really coincidence, through a friend effectively of something you didn't even want to go to. And then was she cutting or doing extensions in color, working in a salon when you met?
No, we were fairly young back then. She was 17 and I was 19.
That's fairly young. So you, 17, was she still in high school?
She was in high school because she was homeschooled and she graduated earlier. If you're homeschooled, you can speed up kind of the whole process.
Yeah.
So she was graduated by then. And yeah, so it was interesting because my intention wasn't really to date anybody seriously, but just her background was very intriguing to me. Someone that lives out in the country, someone that has horses. And I guess same thing for her. She was intrigued by my culture, and she's never met anybody from Russia. And then, you know, as we began talking, she introduced me to her parents. And so it was something we just clicked, and we realized that, yeah, this is it.
So what did she do and what did you do before you really ultimately started the salon? She was working in a salon before you started your current salon, right?
Correct. Yeah. So fast forward a few years later, after we got married, I was 21 and she was 19 when we got married. So we got married very young. I worked for communications company back then, being on the phone, answering phone calls. And this is kind of the beginning stage of my career, working at a corporate environment. So this is where I started. And while I was starting that career, she went to hair school. And so she graduated a year later from the hair school while I was still growing, you know, my career at my corporate office. So, and then that's kind of where I continued to grow with the company. And then eventually I got into the leadership side of things with the company. And then this is where she started moving salons from one salon to another salon. Then she did booth rental. She rented her own booth and was kind of her own business. And this is where the plan came together. We're going to do something completely different. We're going to do a salon that's very different, very unique. And we're going to focus on specific services, and that's the hair extension services.
I want to get to that, but was it hard being married young?
Not at all. Not for us, at least. Now that we're here, we think about, wow, we were so young. But at the same time, I think we are where we are because we did get married young. And I think having the challenges that you go through, whether it's financially, whether it's with your careers, but having a partner to help you live through those obstacles creates a bond. You're not just happy together because the life is good, career is good. You're happy because you've lived through different challenges and struggles, which makes the connection even better. And now there's this appreciation for one another that we lived through challenges together. We going out to eat, for example, when you're first married, you can't just afford to go out to eat at a nice restaurant every day. So to us, you know, we picked a day, one day out of a month where we went to go out to eat. And that was like a celebration for us. So being where we were to where we are now and seeing each other grow, whether it's mentally, whether it's whatever the case might be, I think it helped us tremendously.
Well, looking back on this topic for people and some younger people listening, what do you think the key to maintaining a healthy, happy marriage is?
I don't think it's just one thing. I think there's several things. If I was going to narrow it down to maybe like a concept, I would say not being selfish. If your whole outlook is, what do I do today to make my spouse happier? What can I do today to get my spouse to the goal that she wants to be, and vice versa? This is kind of the concept. That's not the 50-50 concept. That's, I'm putting you first at all times. And the same thing happens on the other end. And I think that was key for us. I just wanted to make my wife happy, and she wanted to make me happy. And so our decisions were always in sync as a result.
I think that's good advice. I don't want to limit you. If you have other ones, you can offer. My, after 27 years, insight is that, which I think is very similar to what you said, which is you have to have an existing life before you enter into a relationship with another human. And only then can you actually execute on what you just said, because otherwise there's insecurities and that leads to dysfunction. And it's not healthy for anyone. So if you have an existing life and some semblance of who you are, meaning you're not in this deep search, not that that's bad. It just, if you've reconciled that or have a grip on it, however you do, like I'd say 90% is good enough, right? 100% would always be hard because you're always changing and discovering, and maybe it's 85%. But if there's anything less than that, I just don't think you get there because you are insecure, and when another person makes a move possibly ahead or different than where you are, you get insecure and it creates a lot of jealousy and things like that. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a big part of making marriage work. And you will always have challenges. If someone says that if there's a perfect marriage, they're lying, right? So yeah, there will always be challenges, but really focusing on making the other person happy. And when you see the other person happy that you truly love, you enjoy doing any sacrifice that you can for that person. You're not doing it because you're required. You're doing it because you're now enjoying it because you love that person so much. So I think it's, unless you know this is the right person, just don't get married. This would be the other advice. But, and I've never had the intention of getting married that young. It's just the right person came along and I realized, wow, this person is exactly who I want to spend my life with, because this person is so transparent. They're so honest and kind. And the list goes on and on. That you know when it's the right person. And if there's any doubt in your mind that it's not, maybe it's not.
I think that's good advice. You and I could do a whole show on that, but I felt like since you've had some success, it was worth talking about. 1996, your family comes to America. You land in Boston. You come to Kentucky. You meet your wife, you get married at young age, 21, you're 21, she's 19. You start a corporate career. Amy goes to salon school, year later gets out, goes into these salons and jumps around, basically doesn't have a good experience. And one day comes to you and says, I want to open my own salon.
Yeah, it started when she was a booth runner.
A booth runner. Can you talk about the business model of the traditional salons and then what you and Amy came up with for your current model?
Yeah, absolutely. So you have your corporate-based salons. These salons are more like chain-like salons. Then you have your small business salons. You know, someone that's an artist, they have friends that do hair, and they say, hey, let's just open up a salon together. We're ready to do hair. We might as well do it in our own place. So, and then you have booth rental salons where someone leases the large space and then they take that space. I could be a stylist and I'm leasing this large space where I do hair, but I also have chairs that I can rent out to other stylists, and they pay me either weekly or monthly for leasing the chair. But I do my own booking. I try to get my own clients. So there's different versions or variations of that too. And then you have your salons where you're a commission-based salon. So when Amy was doing booth rental, her idea was, I want to open a commission-based salon where we would manage a lot of the challenges that booth renters have, because you have to manage your own book, schedule your own appointments, have to recruit, find a way to get more clients in. But how do we create a commission-based salon where the team is still making a decent living wage without the hardships of what it takes to run your own business? And so part of our business plan, going back to that, we actually did an analysis of what is the average pay for stylists within 150-mile radius based on the available data that's out there. And there's several companies that provide you some of the data. It's not 100% accurate. There's different things that could kind of skew the data a little bit, but we looked at the average and then what is the top 10% of the earners and how do we create a plan where we get everybody to the top 10%? And we did it. We're here. You know, we are, our stylists are, if you take the average of the total earnings from a salary perspective, yearly perspective, we're the top 10. We have the top 10 best paid stylists within 150-mile radius.
Well, that's incredible. Congratulations on that. What is that structure? And can you also talk about the benefits, which are very non-traditional for the salon industry, that effectively has led to one of the best workplaces to work in America, according to Inc. magazine?
Yeah. So part of the structure was we first had to make a decision. Are we going to bring someone that has already a book of clients that they service, and we get them to bring that book into this new salon that we're opening? Or do we go after new students straight out of school so that we can develop them from the start and develop them with the right behaviors? Because a lot of the challenges that you can run into is if someone already established as a stylist, they have what we call baggage that comes with that. And so to have to kind of redirect or reposition someone, or maybe have to work with some of existing habits that might not work with the brand, could prove to be a challenge. And so our idea from the start was to bring new talent in so that we can develop that talent into what we would think is your top of the line stylist. And so that's what we did. And then part of creating an environment is we knew from the start that we will have what we call journeys or a coaching development plans for each stylist. So there are specific goals and targets that we will have in place to have them continuously grow year over year to get to that top 10% of being a top paid stylist. So that's part of it. And then the other part of that too is, how do we create an environment where it's drama free? And it's hard because as humans, we all have bad days. We have good days. We could be upset at something just for the moment, might say something that we didn't mean just because we were just in that temporary state of mind. So you can't really control life. Life happens. But what we knew is that we can control the overall environment and the things that we want to instill into the culture of the team. And one of those things is, I'm not here by myself. I'm here with a team, and the team will be there to support me fully. And to create this kind of a team environment, it requires everybody to work closely together. So you see a stylist that maybe is running behind, and another stylist that maybe got done a little bit sooner, they'll walk over and help their team member work on the client together, whether, you know, this person follows this side of the hair or this side of the hair, or if we're installing extensions, there's different things that you can do to speed up the process to get that person back on the right time schedule. So, and this is very different. That's not typical. And the first thing that if we bring new talent in, that's the first thing they notice, like, wow, I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen the team work together. And most importantly, I never saw a salon owner step in and help. And so that's a big part of it, is there's plenty of things to do. We can be here 24/7 and we will never feel like we finished our tasks. There's so many tasks for business owners, but she'll take the time and she will help. And so I think that's a big key. It's teamwork environment where I'm celebrating your successes, you're celebrating my successes, and we're in it to make sure we're all successful and we're not separating each other in a way to where, all right, I'm going to make this decision that will hurt you, but make me be better. And so we avoid this specific challenge as much as possible. And this is how we created this environment.
This episode is sponsored by the Halle Financial Team at Expert Lending. Buying a house in today's market is competitive, and you need a lender that can close fast and get you the very best rate. The team is licensed in 48 states and has over 20 years experience in the real estate and lending space and access to lending rates that most mortgage brokers can't get. I know because I'm an investor in the team. If you need a mortgage or know someone that does, call or text Kara at 571-271-9086 and talk to a real human who will give you the customer service you deserve. Again, call or text Kara at 571-271-9086. 9086. Now back to the show. I want to break that down a little bit further because behaviors are driven by incentives. So you can preach a culture and you can certainly demonstrate and lead a culture. But if the incentive structure behind those behaviors that you're trying to get, as an example, a stylist is struggling or behind in the day schedule, which happens with all of us, especially in salons, because the lady that I go to is on my butt that if I'm 7 minutes late, yeah, it's over. Because the rest of her day is totally, I mean, it's back to back and I don't get a break and I can't eat lunch. And God, it's like one of the hardest jobs. I standing on your feet like that all day. I was thinking, do you have an incentive structure where it's not just commission, but there's also an incentive structure where people share in the overall profitability so that someone is not just incentivized to help because it's the culture and expected. I mean, so I guess where I'm going with this is you can motivate someone. If you look at behaviors and habits and you have a motivation goes on the y-axis and then you have ease of use or some other selector along the bottom, usually you can get a behavior to happen if you motivate people. But motivation is not a sustainable thing because every time you don't do it, I have to bring you back up to get that behavior. Whereas if it's easy to do and or there's some sort of ease, meaning you're incentivized, you can keep that behavior without ever having to motivate anyone because you've used another dimension to do that. So do you have any sort of pay structure that helps reinforce that behavior?
Yes, but we look at it a little bit differently. We have what we call a sliding scale, where the sliding scale shifts every 2 weeks based on certain number and certain elements that we look at to evaluate whether or not you should be realigned on that sliding scale. So that's one part of it. The other part of it too is we have different level of style. So we have level one, level two, level three, level four. And so as you get promoted from level one to level two to level three, there's also a way to get yourself noticed and a way for you to promote yourself to a different level. And there's the financial benefits of moving up a level. And then the other part, the other benefit, which is very non-standard in this industry, it's as a stylist, if I want to get certified, let's say to do a certain type of extensions, typically what salons will do is they'll cover a percentage of the certification or they'll cover it, but then every paycheck, they take a percentage out to reimburse themselves. From the start, part of our business plan was we will never do that. We will always pay 100% for every certification, any up training, any training that they would want to take, we will pay for it 100%. But in order to get to that point, there has to be certain behaviors in place so that we're comfortable knowing that if the behaviors are in place and you're taking the certification, you will 100% benefit from it. There will be a return on investment from it, but you have to make sure you show yourself in a manner to where, okay, yeah, this person is fully invested. We need to make sure we continue to push them and motivate them, and we'll cover all these costs associated with continuing education. So And this is what we do. And this is so not non-standard. We, for example, just a few months ago, we flew the entire team to Austin, Texas for an international Kevin Murphy hair show. We got VIP tickets. We covered for their flights. We covered their hotel stay, their transportation. The entire team got to go. And this is another way of really building this environment, building this culture. It's, we will do this together. We're going to do things differently, but it requires us to operate as a team. And so that's the other incentive. It's they get to participate in these events. We do this yearly. The year before that, we all traveled to Florida and we spent a few days there. And then we always take one extra day to kind of spend time, whether at the beach or discover in the city. So 2 days typically is the show or the expo that's happening. And then one day we use it for team building activities outside of our town.
So you do have that in place and it makes sense, which is you do have this incentive structure based on financials. It doesn't always have to be financials, but in the for-profit world, it usually is somewhat around financials. Is if someone walks in and is having a bad day, they will check themselves because that level, four levels that you have, they still got to sort of put that aside and contribute because you're actually implementing something that's very interesting, which is selection's an ongoing process because you're measuring every 2 weeks. So it's not even like someone has to wait 6 months. It sounds like you and Amy are doing this selection's an ongoing process and it allows someone to actually speed up or slow down depending on their, whatever they choose to effectively do.
Yeah, it's pretty close to what you said. The only difference is the levels don't change every 2 weeks. The commission structure, the sliding scale changes every.
Oh, the sliding scale. So it's, yeah, right. That would make sense. You can't be going from 1 to 3 to 3 to 1 all the time. And but the incentive structure.
Yeah, the levels change based on someone's experience, talent level, certifications, et cetera.
How do you protect yourself? This has been something I've struggled with for a long time is you want to get your people trained. And you want, because the ROI on your business, it's evident your people are smarter, they're more equipped, and that's going to make your business better. But in doing that, I'm interested in your thoughts on this. You have actually increased, so you've paid to increase their experience, which you've effectively, they've had the ability to charge more for who they are because of their experience. And then they come back to you and say, well, now you should give me a raise. And there's this thing in your head as a business owner that says, yeah, but I paid for the education. And then if they got upset, I'm just using this case. I'm not saying it obviously doesn't happen, but it can. And I've run into it. They leave. And now you just paid because for them to get better because you want that for them and you want that for your business and your team. And now you're out this money. So I've struggled with it and basically said that I'll do it like you. Like I want people to be better and get better for all the reasons. I don't want you to hold that against me right away. So I have to pay you more. And then two is if you leave, you are going to owe some money. So how do you guys and Amy handle that situation?
Yeah, I think this is the most challenging of all topics. So I can tell you how we started versus where we are right now. And this is one of those things where we learn from our mistakes. So when we originally put together the business plan from the start, we knew that that was going to be a challenge. Is we're going to grow someone and then they're going to leave after getting a full book of clients that essentially you've delivered to them. You got them trained. And so how do we prevent this person from leaving? And so my original idea was that we should have non-compete agreements. We have to have some kind of contracts to protect us. And so those are scary. Who wants to sign a non-compete agreement? So the way Amy looked at it, she said, okay, I don't think we need non-competes because if we do create this kind of environment and the environment is we're making them successful, they're happy here and they get paid enough to stay where they don't have to do all this other stuff and jump from one salon to another, I don't think we'll run into that challenge as much as we think we will because we won't have that kind of environment that they're wanting to run away from and they're not feeling like they're not making enough money to make a living. So that's where we started. So, okay, let's test that theory out. We brought in 3 new stylists that had no existing clientele. We fully booked them within the first 9 months. Their book was it was something that's not typical as well, where you're within your first year out of school, you can have a full clientele. But we did it because we knew how we're going to do it, what we're going to do, and how we're going to attract these clients. And that's exactly what happened. We had those stylists ended up leaving and doing booth rental stuff. So this is where we went back to the drawing board and said, okay, so the environment, the growth doesn't, as much as we want it to be, it doesn't do the trick. So then we will look back at, again, the non-compete agreements. And what would, if we do implement a non-compete agreement, which is a very, it's a scary term. Sometimes you have to be an attorney to fully understand what's inside a non-compete agreement. And so our idea was like, if we're going to implement it, how do we become extremely transparent about what it does and how it will affect them for the rest of their career potentially? So we put together a non-compete agreement that basically says, if you end up no longer being part of the Emma Justine team, we call it Emma Justine Tribe. If you end up not being part of the Emma Justine team, you can still work and do a hair. You just can't do it within a 10-mile radius of the salon. And so we put a radius around the salon because we knew the market that we were targeting, and we knew that if they end up moving to a different place, even if it does have an impact, that it's an impact that we're willing to be okay with. And most of our guests, when they come to the salon, they don't always come because of the styles. That's a big part of it, but they also come because of the environment, because of what the Emma Justine brand represents. And so we have a non-compete agreement that everybody signs, and it restricts them from working within a 10-mile radius for 2 years. So, and then on top of that too, it's okay, so, but how do I know if this is the right environment? So the way we did it is we bring you on board. We don't have you sign a non-compete right away. You actually spend 30 days with us. We get to interact with you. You get to interact with us. You don't just see us being happy all the time because of the initial honeymoon phases of being a new employee and everything is great. And 2 weeks later, then there's some maybe confrontations or something that maybe somebody says. So it requires a full 30 day to really see the good and the challenges and really know whether or not this is the right environment. And so what we do, we give them the non-compete agreement. As soon as we hire them, they take it home with them. They can look over it 100 times. They can have somebody else look at over it. They spend 30 days with us. And on that 30-day mark, we meet and we say, all right, this is your 30-day mark. What do you think about the environment? Is this the kind of environment you want to be a part of? And do you feel comfortable with the non-compete? Have you had, you know, a chance to review it? Are you comfortable with it? Are we going to make this partnership work? And so this is where we are right now.
Well, that's very interesting. And for the salon-based business, which is very much regional, people outside a radius will come. But in general, people want, there's all these crazy things when you start studying it around people don't cross bridges, even if it's right around the corner. I live in Half Moon Bay, California. On the other side of the Santa Cruz Mountains is this thing called the Bay Area. I mean, I live on the peninsula, which is the Bay Area, but the mountain range divides us about a third on the coast. It's 7 miles, Nissan, 7 miles. It's actually only about 5 to get over the hill. And you're basically going from a very country, rural, coastal, surfing cowboy town to modern tech. Mm-hmm. It's not that there's not tech over here, but, and it's amazing that people won't cross the mountain and it's 7 miles and they're like, oh my God, I got to go over the hill. So what you did, because I was thinking when you're like, oh, I'm going to do a non-compete. I was like, you can't do a non-compete. I mean, you can't keep someone from doing their profession. It's very hard, but you and Amy came up with something that's just genius, which is we're not going to keep you from doing anything, but you can't do it within 10 miles, which is fair. Do you have any heartburn over someone leaving and you just paid within 8 months for invested in them to go on one of these incredible trips that you do and then they leave? Or do you just, I mean, it sounds like Amy, I like that approach. Like if we do it, we're going to bet on ourselves, but there's still heartburn that you probably get when you have to look at that spreadsheet that 8 months ago, you just spent equivalent of $4,000, $5,000 on whatever it winds up being, which is not cheap to get VIP tickets to any event, hotel, airfare, and food on a daily basis. Do you guys just not worried about that at that point?
There is a heartburn, and it's not necessarily the financial aspect of it. The heartburn is more about we're fully invested into our team. We have these monthly one-on-ones where we get like get to spend time with them. We know them. We root for them. We want them to be successful. And so we're doing all these things on the background to really create what we call a profile card for this person and what this person's image is and how awesome they are. And so we're fully invested in their success. Part of our one-on-ones, we had a one-on-one last month where we spent time helping the person figure out what is the right home mortgage and how to get a home. And so it goes beyond just a business salon related one-on-one. Sometimes it crosses into other things because our goal is to make you successful even outside of the salon. We get into these topics and we're invested in them, not just financially. There are emotional aspects of it. And we do care for their well-being. So that's where the heartbreak is. As far as the financial side of things, we're at the point now where there is a financial impact, but we can weather that financial impact. It's not going to make us no longer provide, you know, wine or champagne like we planned on. We have things in the background that will allow us to continue to operate without worrying about that. And then as far as investing into their education, part of the process is if you end up leaving within a year, then we have to get reimbursed for whatever training that we've provided. The salon covered the expense. So there is a reimbursement on the back end.
I think that's fair. What else do you guys do over there in the way to facilitate this amazing culture?
I think a big part of it is really selecting the right people. What does the interview process look like? How do we ask the right questions? And going back to that 30-day evaluation period, that's a big part of it. It's within 30 days, you should know if someone's going to mesh well with the team. And so that's a big part of it. We also do regular team meetings. We do one-on-ones. We do all these additional things to create a team-like environment. But I think a big part of that too is also the experience that the guests of the salon get. We create an environment, we call it a hair lounge, create an environment where we do offer champagne, we do offer wine. We have even little details that most people don't pay attention to. But when we were remodeling the property that we purchased, we wanted to make sure we had speakers on the outside of the salon so that when someone is parking or driving by, the experience starts not inside, but outside of the salon because they're listening to the music from the inside of the salon. Then we got a lemon tree and a lime tree, like actual trees that produce lemons and limes. And so using those to create lemonade or create a lime water or whatever it is that we decide to do for that week, for that month. So little details like that, it's the entire environment, including the environment that impacts the guests, the environment of, all right, if I'm going to call this on and book an appointment, what does the IVR greeting sound like? Is it upbeat? Is it positive? If I end up wanting to take a vacation and this is my fourth vacation, but I really don't want to miss this vacation because it's really the family that invited me. I really like this family. How do we approve this time off? It's everything combined. It's including approving time off. Yeah, we have a business to operate, but we got to the point where we will always try to approve your time off, no matter how often you ask for it. It's not always paid time off, but we do factor in, you know, unpaid time off. But how do we not deny the unpaid time off? What do we need to make that happen? That goes back to that question. We want to provide so much time off for the team. How do we make it happen? So the way we make it happen is by them being proactive and letting us know so far in advance so that it's not impacting the guests that we now have to reschedule to approve the time off. So we offer time off, and we're the only salon of this caliber that is not open every Saturday of the month. When Amy first said, all right, so I think it's going to really benefit the team if they don't have to be here every single Saturday and they can spend time with their family and friends doing fun things on the weekends. So I think we should close down the salon on a Saturday. When she told me, and I have my manager that sits usually right next to me, Adele, when Amy said that, Adele and I both look at each other like, okay, this is the worst idea we could have possibly heard of. Like, I don't know what made you even think of this. Why would we want to be closed on a Saturday? Some people work Monday through Friday. Saturday is the only day that they can come in. So, but then as I started to think about what would it take to make it happen, we made it happen. So now the salon is closed 3 weekends in a month. We're only open 1 Saturday a month. And so having a 4-day work week where you're off Saturday, Sunday, and Monday is a big deal to someone's happiness and that work-life balance that seems to kind of cross gray areas every once in a while. That's a big part of it as well. It's just, how do we make it happen? So that's the question we always ask, and we make decisions according to that.
I think Monday is such a better day to have off. I hate Mondays. I hate Sunday nights.
It's
stressful.
Because you're potentially partying on a Sunday. And
well, I'm not partying, just to be clear, Nisa. I'm a little bit older, and I've resigned the fact that that was not going to happen. But for some people, I'm sure it's still, they're still partying on whatever they're doing. But it's just like, it's that, I don't know how to describe it. It's like that abruptness. Like I can work on a Friday. I mean, I try to take off by 1 o'clock on Fridays just because I don't even think most there's not good productivity from any human in general, on a Friday afternoon. And if you haven't gotten your shit done by Friday afternoon, we have a bigger problem.
Yeah.
Now in the salon business, you have hair and things like that, but let's just be honest, like you can do your work. And so, yeah, I think that Monday thing, I told my wife, I was like, I want to take off Mondays, but your employees are all the people. It looked like from your pictures, there was a lot of ladies. Are they employees?
Yes, they're all on a W-2.
They're in a W-2. And then you give them health insurance?
So we don't give them health insurance. It is something that we're researching for this upcoming year. In order for it to really be feasible for a small business, you have to have so many employees to really make it affordable. But it is something that we're actively looking into.
Yeah, I think it's super hard. I think it's my wife and I, for two of us, knock on wood, if you can't hear that and you're listening and you're watching, I knocked on it, is I think just the other day I saw the bill. And for my wife and I, healthy humans who rarely go to the doctor, it's $1,500 or $1,600 a month. And if you do the math there, what is like $22,000, $24,000 of earned income a year going out the door just for health insurance? And as a small business owner myself, like you want, I think you and Amy and me and all small business owners want to be able to provide people with health insurance. Like that's really important. It's a big expense. It's just a mathematical equation. And I think you both can, with that team environment, say, we want to give you health insurance. Here's what we have to do to provide that. And that's a very different, solving for X is a different dynamic than reacting to what revenue is and not trying to figure out X. Because that's what really running a business plan in your financials is. You're always solving for X because you can try to solve for it.
Yeah. Yeah. What would it take to provide insurance? So it would take so many employees, so much revenue, so many employees being so busy. Yeah. It's doable, but we have to come to that point. So it's, you know, long-term strategy versus short-term.
And I think the one thing I did just came to me, I apologize for interrupting you there, but I've been forgetting it for the last time we've been talking, is the big thing is you talked about it, is you give people unlimited, there's no limit to the time off. If they need time off, you give them time off.
That's correct.
Yeah, right. And that's self-regulating. I actually started it. Self-regulating time off. I think sometimes that can backfire because people don't want to take time off, but you have to create a culture that celebrates that versus sort of cocks your head and you're like, oh, you're taking time off again. Like you can't have that reaction. It has to, because people who are rested work better. I've seen a few scientific academic journals show that that's a fact. And in America, I hate to say it's not celebrated, but in general, it's not celebrated and it should be.
Yeah. You know, Brandon, too, it's even working for a corporate environment. Before I left that company, I had a pretty good benefits package and I had 4 weeks of vacation, and I had 2 additional weeks where I could use for like split up and have like doctor appointments. But you can also make, you can say it's 6 weeks of total vacation. That's considered a lot nowadays. Like it's a lot of time. And, but in all honesty, it is, but it's not at the same time. It's this challenge of what is enough time for the needed relaxation? What is enough time for someone to be able to take time off and be fully relaxed and not feel guilty for now missing work again? This is where we came up with that concept. That's, we're not putting a number to it. We're putting the behavior to the request. So if the behaviors are in place, if you're requesting it in advance and you're a good planner and you're strategizing your time off, if you're doing all these things on the back end that really helps us plan better for it, what would it take to give you that time off? Then we can make it happen. So this is how we did it. We were planning for it. We know when they want the time off. We plan for it. We make certain steps leading up to that to make sure there's no need to move guests around, to make sure that we're giving plenty of notice to everybody. And so it's done wonders for us. I can't express how much it helps the overall environment and the overall well-being, how happy someone is when they can take time off when they want to take time off. It doesn't mean you have to be unreasonable and be off 2 weeks, work 2 weeks, be off 2 weeks. There has to be some reasonable, you have to be reasonable when you request the time off, but it's all based on the behaviors. If your behaviors are in the right place and you're planning way in advance, we should be able to make it happen for you. And that's what we do.
Few last questions here, but I think they're important. I wrote them down. You have all these awards in 4 years. How do you do that? How do people find out about you? And what I'm really asking you is, what sort of engine do you have to communicate what you're doing? Because honestly, when I read about you, I thought to myself, I've had salon people on the show, but are we going to have, like, what's special about this salon in Kentucky that is going to bring something to our listeners that, and going to be interesting to talk to you about? And you must have some engine that somebody behind the scenes, maybe you or your manager, are getting the word out somehow. You're on this podcast and I read about you, and that's what really intrigued me to have a conversation. So that's, it sounds like a very purposeful thing for you.
It is very purposeful. We spend a lot of time and energy on the branding side of things. And branding is different sometimes than marketing. Marketing is typically you market a service, you market a salon so that you can bring more revenue to the salon. And a lot of the times, business owners don't always either have the funds for it or don't always put value in what branding the salon is. And how do you brand a salon is by having recognition for doing things above and beyond, right? So just even the very first award that we got, which was the Salon Design Award through Salon Today, it took a lot to get to that point because if I showed you the before and after pictures, you would think I was the craziest person to purchase this property. It was deteriorating beyond what a normal person would think is repairable. We had to lift the property, put new foundation, sink it back in. And then because it was in a historic area, I had to have all this red tape I had to go through. Then there's limitations to how big your sign can be. It can be so many square feet and this and that. So it requires a lot of effort. And a lot of people will give up on some of those little things because they don't see value in it. Something is small, and I don't want to spend too much time on it because I know we've been kind of talking for over an hour, but something as simple as like the sign on the salon. There's a clause in Middletown where you can't have a salon over so much square feet. So in my mind, I'm always looking, what would it take to have a sign that I want, but not have the historic commission and the red tape constantly give me issues about what it is that I'm trying to do? So I read through the entire clause and I realized that there's ways to go about it. And the first way is I'm not going to have a banner. I'm going to have just letters. And if I just use the letters and I count the square footage of each letter, then I can put it on the building and have a wide enough sign because I'm only counting square footage of the letters without the banner behind it. If I put the banner, now the banner is taking up the unnecessary space. So the front of the salon now just has letters and it's all the way across the building. A normal person wouldn't fight so hard to do that, but we did because that is our brain. That's how we brand ourselves. We do something that's different and we're the only one on the street that now has it. And then reading further into the clauses doesn't say that you can't have a building and then a separate standalone sign. So now we have two signs. And as soon as we started that, it was a wave on our street. We had people start to do the exactly same thing. We have a school that we have a really good relationship with right across the street. That's exactly what they did. They took a stencil. They have a brick building. They took a stencil, put it on the building, and they stenciled their branding or their school name without the backboard. And now they have two signs as well because they're within that square footage limitation. So this is how we do it. You have to really put in the effort to care about those things and put up a fight. It took us 6 months to just go through the red tape before we began the renovation process, which is also very costly. You know, and a normal person would be like, okay, who cares? Just make the sign smaller. We care. We care about having speakers outside. I had to make sure I had had conversations about that. And is it going to really impact the neighborhood? And how far is the house, residential home, from our property? And so really what it takes is really fighting for what you want. And then it does get noticed. And so I think that's a big part of the other part of the branding is networking with the right individuals and really helping other businesses without seeking to have some kind of return back. Truly just making an effort to help your fellow business owner. I want to share the story, which is, I think you'd get a kick out of this. When we were growing the salon, we got to the point where we realized that we were going to be so specific in the services we provide that we will no longer be doing just haircuts. So we had male guests that would come in, they would just get a haircut. And at some point, you can't raise the prices so high because it then ethically becomes not the right thing to do, but they kept coming. It's like your haircut is $75 and we can't really make it $100. Like it's not that we will do it and they will pay for it, but we can't, it won't be the right thing to do. So we were just trying to figure out, okay, we want to be a specialty salon. We don't want to do haircuts. We want to do extensions, blonding, extensive coloring services, like these massive services that require someone to really use their talent and skill. So what do we do with the guests that have built this relationship with us that just get a haircut or just get a base color? Making the judgment call of, okay, we're going to tell these guests we have to find them another salon home. If you ever had to experience anxiety, that was one of those things where my anxiety was through the roof, right? And so that was Amy's thing is like, this is what we need to do. How do we make it happen? And so we went back to the drawing board. We partnered up with two salons, one across the street, another salon that's not too far from here that we knew could live up to the standard that they were used to at our salon. We called them and we said, Adele called the salon across the street and said, hey, we have a clientele book and we want to transfer them over to you, make that transfer smooth and it'll help your stylist grow, it'll help your salon grow. We'll provide the formulas over to you and all the details once we have the conversations. I just want to make sure you guys can take on this type of book and that you guys can provide the service. They thought we were playing a prank, but we were crazy. Like, that's no way they would just send us guests. But that's what we did. We were happy doing it and it was a smooth transition. So that's the other way. It's you network, you do the right thing. I think that's how the recognition is coming about.
Well, you beat me to it because that was the other thing on my list is you have niched down. And for business owners, even myself, I actually have a sign behind me because my co-founder in this software company just recently, and I'm not saying I have a ton of experience, but I got 2 decades under my belt and sometimes should know better. We all say that. And we were having a conversation and I said, no, we're not going to be able to cover everything. Like, I want to be able to reach all these potential people. He's like, no, we're going to solve one problem. And you just need to be, and he said to me, like, of all people, Brandon, like, you're one of the biggest risk takers I know in this of sense of doing new business ventures and everything. He's like, why don't you just be brave? That's actually that sign behind me because it's super hard and scary as shit to do what you did, which is niche down and you're only doing extensions in color. But it's amazing actually what happens on the backside if you can weather that storm of anxiety to do it. So, I mean, did you push back? You said, Amy said, hey, Nissan, this is what we got to do. This is the way it's going to be. Was it as short as that conversation or did it take a minute to digest and say, okay, we're pushing the chips and we're going all in?
Yeah. When she said this is where she would want to be, she knew she was determined that this is kind of the end result is for us to grow and to do what we want to do. This is where we want to be. It's more about how do we get there? How long would it take? How do we do this? And so it was a scary thought, just like it was shutting the salon down on a Saturday and having to tell these guests that cannot come in on a weekday. How do you tell someone, hey, we thank you for coming and supporting our business, but we can no longer service you because we're not open on a Saturday? How do you tell a guest that? And so there's the financial impact of it. It's what percentage of the guests will, the fallout. What's the fallout? Like, what percentage of guests will no longer come? Will we get negative reviews as a result of it? How do we tackle those obstacles? Because it will happen and it did happen, but we were so prepared each time when we had the plan and we executed, the execution was flawless. I'm not saying that there weren't challenges that we ran into, but we had it ironed out to the point where we thought through every possible scenario, how we're going to tackle it. Who's going to talk to the guest? If it's escalated, how is it going to flow to the next person in line? If Adele is talking, our manager is talking to them, and they're escalating, how do I reach back out to them? What conversation would that look like? So it's just really having a solid plan and being able to execute it. Going back to losing the Saturday working day, I realized I knew exactly what the impact would be as far as revenue. But then we also realized that now we're squeezing more people in during the week. And if this percent is the fallout and this percent moves into those other days, we're essentially creating a more demand without having the availability. And when that happens, it's only a matter of time before you have such a demand and no availability, and then you can start raising prices to make up for the loss of revenue. And so this is how we executed that plan.
It's amazing what a spreadsheet can do, huh?
Absolutely.
I mean, you model it, you have anxiety around it, you kill your haircuts, but you realize that by killing the haircuts, you backfill with hair coloring and extension, which from my understanding with a wife is very expensive. So your average revenue per user actually more than quadrupled if I do the math, even at $75, because my wife gets her hair colored. I don't think that's like revealing any magical thing that anybody would not know, but especially when you have part of it purple, or the under part of it purple, is it's hundreds of dollars.
It is.
And in many ways.
Yeah, it is too. And then for us, in order to be known as like the extension destination, you can't just say I'm an extension destination. Like, first of all, your work has to be there. But then what we did completely different in our areas, when you walk in, you see an extension wall rack from floor to ceiling of just hair extensions. And that is like close to $80,000 just hanging on the wall. And so the first idea is like, well, why have so much hair extensions? That's expensive. You can use that money for that. But that's part of that branding, that image. It's if you want to be known as the extension destination, and this is what you're best at, you have to have extensions in stock and it has to be on display. And so we have so much hair extensions in stock where there's no question that we are the destination for being able to do hair extensions and we're the best at it. And so that's how we accomplish that side of things, is we want to have a niche and we're going to be really good at what we do.
What's next for you guys?
So that's a great question. I wasn't really prepared to speak for it, but we're actually in the process of launching an extension hairline where we will provide the hair extensions to other salon owners and other stylists. And there's a problem to solve there. And we want to become the solution. The solution is, if you can afford to have $80,000 worth of hair extensions on the wall, but you have guests that you service and need the hair the next day, how do we deliver that hair to you the next day and not charge an arm and a leg and provide extensions that are high quality extensions? So we've put together, it's called Mint Beauty Hair Extensions or Mint Extensions. We put together a plan where we will be able to solve the solution that so many salons and stylists have, where they can pick up hair same day or have it delivered next day within a certain radius of our city, or we will have it overnighted to you pretty much in any part of the United States, and we won't charge you extra for it. And something nobody else does is guarantee hair extensions. And we guarantee hair extensions where if you're not satisfied with the quality, you get to send it back. So that's kind of the next stepping stone. We have the site is up. We have the inventory. We have everything we need. We're just working out some additional execution strategy to make sure that we're doing it the right way. But we're hoping to launch it by end of this month.
You think you'll open another salon?
A lot of people ask me that. We would like to. And we looked at markets such as St. Petersburg, Florida. We looked at markets such as Austin, Texas. We would like to do it. I think if we do end up doing it, it'll be not that far so that we can drive to the location. And if we do it, it'll be probably somewhere across the bridge, next state over. But I don't think that's a priority for us. I think our priority right now is to continue to grow the existing space and then the extension side of things where we distribute the extensions to other salons. But yes, long-term strategy, we do have it in our strategy to open up a second location, and we've narrowed down the area that we want to be in, but it is not a priority and we can postpone that date as far as we want to, and it won't really create any kind of heartaches for us.
Well, it sounds like this other business allows you to scale much larger and touch a larger, you meet all of the salons that need extensions. So I think that can be a great business for you. And I'm really grateful for the conversation. It's been a lot of fun. If you had to whittle down all the experiences that you and your wife have had in building a great workplace in an industry, a challenging industry that normally isn't able to accomplish that. So not only is it hard to create a great workplace that wins an award like you did from Inc. Magazine, but do it in an industry that's super hard. What three pieces of advice would you give listeners looking to replicate your type of success in the workplace?
Yeah, I think the first one would be is not to feel sorry for yourself. It's so easy to get into that state of mind where I'm putting 24 hours, I'm working so much, it's so complicated. Then you look at social media and then you get distracted by what you're not doing. And so you get to the point where you feel sorry for yourself, then you get demotivated by the social media and what you are and what you're not doing. So I think the piece of advice is don't feel sorry for yourself. If you're a true entrepreneur and you truly have the desire to grow your business, you should never feel sorry for how much time you're putting in at work. And you should not feel demotivated by what other people are doing and how much they're growing. You're your own business. Grow yourself. Grow your business. Don't get demotivated by other success. For example, in Louisville, in Kentucky, we have over 1 million people. You can have plenty of good salons. Plenty of salons that are successful and still be happy. We don't look at them as, we study them, but we don't look at them as competition. They're partners. And so having the right mentality, all these other businesses are partners. Don't get motivated by their success. Focus on you. And then also don't feel sorry for yourself. And then the third part of it is know the data, know the numbers, understand, study, have a profit and loss statement, have that Excel spreadsheet. If you don't know how to put one, learn it. There's so much resources online where you can learn all these things. I have a GED. I don't even have a high school diploma. I don't have a university degree, but I'm able to do these things. And so those would be the three advices. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Do not get demotivated by social media and what other people are doing. Also, invest time in learning and understanding the data and the numbers behind the business.
Those were awesome, Nissan. Thanks for sharing those. Where can listeners find out more about Emma Justine Lounge and your new business? We will, of course, put this in the show notes, but for listeners out there, where can they find you?
Our website, emmajustinesalon.com. We have a lot of fun on our social media, so follow us on Instagram at Emma Justine Salon. We do a lot of live videos. We're very transparent on social media, so follow us there. You can also see some amazing transformations. And then mentextensions.com is the website that's already up and running for those that want to purchase hair extensions.
Could you spell that? Is it M-I-N-T?
M-E-A-N-T, extension.
M-E-A-N-T, extensions.com. We'll put that in the show notes, listeners. Nissan, thanks so much for taking time out of your day. This has been a ton of fun and you've been really transparent. Congratulations on your success so far. I know that you've got some big things and success on the horizon.
Thanks, Brandon. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Bye, everyone.